The U.S. economy grows.
Not so fast.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in New York. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org for Friday, January 27th.
Coming up, a look at the Arab Spring 1 year later.
Twitter says it's going to start censoring some tweets.
And later, happy Earned Income Tax Credit Awareness Day. That's a real thing, and you'll hear about it next on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
The U.S. GDP grew at a rate of 2.8% at the end of last year. Gross domestic product is a measure of all the goods and services the country produces. It's considered to be the economic indicator. Jill Schlesinger joins us now to talk GDP. She's the editor-at-large for CBS MoneyWatch. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
So, Jill, we just got word that GDP grew 2.8% in the fourth quarter. Good news, bad news?
Mets and mets. It's about the long-term average growth for a for the economy, but it really is low for a recovery. Now, the other part is analysts had expected growth of 3%. There were even some whispers of maybe they were just hopeful ones. Oh, it would be higher. So I think it's a little bit of a disappointment this morning, actually.
Well, Jill, what kind of growth would you have liked to see? And what would that look like on the ground in the economy?
You know, if growth were above 3%, maybe even 3.5% for a few quarters in a row, some consistent growth, here's what would happen. We'd see a general uptick in economic activity, maybe some more stores opening than closing, companies hiring, and really more importantly, confidence in both consumers and businesses.
What was holding us back last quarter?
Well, the big one appears to be business spending, which business spending on capital goods, that's big stuff, slowest since 2009. I think that has a lot to do with the European debt crisis. So maybe if that gets resolved, it'll tick up again after in the first quarter. But on top of that, an index for personal spending rose at just 0.7%. That's the slowest increase in a year and a half. So I don't know, maybe consumers weren't spending quite as freely as we thought in the fourth quarter and during the holiday season.
Jill Schlesinger with CBS Money Watch. Thank you, Jill.
Take care.
Well, for more on the GDP, we're going to bring in Gus Fauché. He is a senior economist at PNC Bank, and he's with us now from Philadelphia. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So, Gus, is this 2.8% a good number, a bad number, or neither?
Well, it's an okay number. If the economy were doing well, if the unemployment rate were 5 or 6%, it would be a very good number. But given that we still have a lot of slack in the economy, that the unemployment rate is 8.5%, I'd have to say it's disappointing.
Well, I have to say a lot of people seem to agree with you this morning that it's not what most people were hoping for. But if you compare it to other developed economies, say in Europe, it is pretty good, right?
That's certainly the case. It looks like Europe may be sliding into recession. They've got their financial crisis there. They're dealing with the effect of big government budget cuts. And so compared to Europe, we're doing a little bit better. But still, again, given where we are in the recovery, I would have liked to have seen stronger growth.
Well, what does this say about our recovery? We're almost 4 years out from the financial crisis. Is this an L-shaped recovery, one that just sort of dropped off and stayed flat?
Well, it's been an L-shaped recovery so far. I think there's the potential for it to turn into a U-shaped recovery, a very shallow U, where on the right-hand side where we have growth picking up. You know, I do think that we will see a stronger recovery over the next year or two, but we've had some significant drags that have weighed on growth, and it's been disappointing.
Gus Fauché is senior economist at PNC Bank. Thanks so much, Gus.
Thank you.
Twitter is aflutter this morning. The social networking site has just announced that it's developed a sensor which will allow it to block certain tweets depending on location. Twitter said that will help it enter countries that have, quote, different ideas about free speech. Jennifer Collins has that story.
Twitter says it will now be able to select tweets with illegal content and stop users in certain countries from seeing them. In the past, if a tweet was deemed illegal, the company had to delete it across the entire world. In a blog post, Twitter gave an example of pro-Nazi speech. It's banned in France and Germany, but legal in the U.S. because of the First Amendment. Analyst Richard Holloway with Tech Market View says this is just the latest tech company that's tweaking the way it works in order to get more users abroad.
If you look at many of the decisions, they've been taken for purely commercial reasons.
Twitter hinted in its post that it wouldn't block speech like tweets used by protesters in the Arab Spring. But what about China?
People still operate in China, and they do it because it is in the future going to be the largest single marketplace for products, everything from Apple through to Google.
Twitter has been blocked in China since 2009. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Well, even if you don't use Twitter, you can't deny the impact those 140-character messages have had on real-life events. The Arab Spring, of course, may not have happened as quickly as it did without ordinary people being able to communicate with each other via Twitter. Well, the Arab Spring is celebrating its first anniversary this week. Our own Stephen Beard is in Cairo looking at the economy there 1 year on, and today he takes a look at the ongoing protests in Egypt and why some Egyptians say they're hurting the economy.
Another fiery orator belts out his message in Tahrir Square. Down with Mubarak, death to dictatorship, out with the military council. This doesn't go down well here in the Khan Bazaar, which is eerily quiet. The tourists have been frightened away from Egypt, and the stallholders here blame the protesters. Yasser Mahmoud Ali has seen his souvenir sales slump by 80% over the past year. He says, I'm fed up with the people in Tahrir. I want them to leave and leave us in peace. He and his brother Tamir supported the revolution. But now, Tamir says, democracy is on its way. Egypt must get off the protest bandwagon and start earning its living.
No state in Tahrir, no talking in Tahrir. Finish. Now we need working.
This is not just an anguished cry from the souk. From her stylish office overlooking the Nile, the head of a leading economics think tank, Magda Kandil, delivers the same message to the protesters.
Shut up and just wait it out till the process is complete and allow the country to recover from all this lingering uncertainty.
She claims the continuing protests have also put off much-needed foreign investment. She says everyone should calm down and take the military at its word. The army has pledged to hand over power in June. But while Gamel, managing editor of El Sharik newspaper, is sceptical, he thinks the protesters are right.
Ordinary Egyptians want their lives to get better, and this didn't happen. So they will continue to protest, to revolt. We're waiting for the next confrontation. And it's going to happen.
The Tahrir protesters are beginning to look like a permanent fixture. Egypt's Arab Spring could yet stretch into a series of long, hot summers. In Cairo, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
So, Jeremy, are you a fan of Bjork?
I like Bjork, yeah, absolutely.
Well, she has a new gig, which you will be interested in hearing about.
Selling swan coats?
Actually, that's not a bad idea. She is going to be teaching middle school science.
Wow.
In Queens.
Queens, New York.
Queens, New York.
Wow.
Exactly. It's kind of a different turn of events for the eclectic Icelandic singer. She'll be holding a series of classes at a Queens museum, and students will write songs and use iPhone apps to learn different scientific concepts. No word yet on whether the students will be able to sing their way out of dissecting a frog.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
The Defense Department has outlined a plan to cut $500 billion from its budget over the next decade. For some context, that's about how much the Pentagon spends every year. The cuts would come from slashing the size of the military and reducing war spending, and they'd have a big impact on companies that make equipment for the military. As Christopher Worth reports from London, those companies are already looking overseas for new customers.
Take Lockheed Martin. Yesterday, the defense contractor announced it's making less money. That's a concern because the company is currently in charge of what could turn out to be the most expensive military program in U.S. history. The F-35 stealth fighter is the only new state-of-the-art fighter jet under development in the Western world. Critics say it will go down as a boondoggle. But to share the costs, Gareth Jennings, a defense analyst at IHS Jane's, says Lockheed's plan has always been to market more of the planes abroad, and the new defense cuts makes that even more important.
The more export customers there are for this aircraft, the cheaper the unit price for the U.S.
Last month, Japan said it would buy 42 of the new jets. No surprise, South Korea says it's considering the F-35.
Once one country goes for a fifth-generation fighter, it's almost kind of one-upmanship then, and, you know, neighboring countries will want the F-35 also.
As for whether the sales will risk the U.S. military's technological advantage, Jennings says foreign buyers may not have access to all the new jet's most sophisticated features. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
So last night's Republican presidential debate in Florida, Stacey, did you see it?
I saw part of it.
I saw part of it as well. It covered a lot of ground, and it also covered space. Specifically,
yes.
The four candidates talked about how important Florida's space industry is and how much the country should invest in space. Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich grabbed the most headlines, of course, with his proposal to establish a moon colony.
In today's Midday Extra, we look at how much such a plan would really cost and if it's worth it. To tell us about the pros and cons, we have Neil deGrasse Tyson, director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History. Good morning, Neil.
Thanks for having me.
So is this moon colony idea actually a viable plan, or is this just politicians discussing things for the sake of it?
Well, it's both. I mean, politicians will say, especially politicians vying for office in their campaign tours, will say what the audience wants and needs to hear regionally. So keeping in mind the debate yesterday followed the day after Newt Gingrich's bold "let's go back to space" speech, and Florida has a huge part of its economy based in space research and space exploration. So one would expect comments that feed the energy and interest of that audience, and that's what Newt Gingrich gave. To put an American colony on the moon, that itself, engineers could pull that off. I mean, in the eight years, what did he say, by the end of his second term?
Yeah, that's
as
right.
President. And engineers could pull that off, and the resistance would be cultural, political, financial, and the like.
What would we gain from having a colony on the moon? Let's just give it its absolute best possible light. What does the national economy, not just the space coast in Florida, what does the national economy gain from having that?
Well, you make an excellent point. In the debate last night, Mitt Romney's, one of his comments back to Newt was that candidates say whatever they need in the various states to feed the interest of those states. And he gave a list. So one state needs a bridge, another state needs a tunnel. The difference with space is that space is a national enterprise. Space is part of an American identity in ways that a bridge regionally in one part of the country is not. So then it's really an apples and oranges comparison. What do we gain by a moon base? Well, apart from interesting research one would do on the moon, there's a whole other subtext here, and that is the re-energizing of the American public, the American consciousness, the American culture, with what it is to value science, engineering, and technology again, as we did 50 years ago. So I see ambitious ideas like a moon base, however politically impossible it may sound, if in fact we were to pull it off, the nation that pulls that off is a nation where all of these frontier sciences are valued again. And that's the kind of nation that invents tomorrow's economies. This is the 21st century. If you don't think bold, you're not going to turn the next century into what we all remember the 20th century was for America.
Now, Neil Gingrich was talking about how a goal like setting up a colony on the moon could turn into real private sector economic growth. Can you think of some specific examples of developments that would come from a space colony?
Yeah, he's got some elements wrong there. He thinks he's right, but he's got some important things wrong. Built in deep in his assumptions is that private sector can advance a space frontier. And that's just, there's no evidence for this in the history of human culture. Almost by definition, in a free market economy, the first people to do things that are expensive and risky are not investors. If it's really risky and really expensive and it's never been done before, the capital markets can't value it. Those adventures, such as that of Columbus and of Magellan and of Lewis and Clark, you just go on down the list. They were risky. They were dangerous. The first people out were paid by governments. The individuals, they themselves were surely explorers. But the people who write the checks, that's the government. And when you do that, they get to draw the maps. They tell you what the risks are, where the world ends, where it doesn't. And once that's all established, you can then set up capital markets to value it.
Well, give us then the price tag, your estimate for what the moon colony, the moon base would cost us at this point.
It would, you know, the number was bandied about $500 billion. That's about right, I would say. If that $500 billion would get you a moon colony as well as meaningful efforts to send people to Mars. And people say, oh, that's expensive. They're not thinking about the secondary, tertiary forces that that brings to bear on society. Once kids see that we're doing this as a nation, they then want to become scientists and engineers. Or if, even if they don't, they will value it as something that the nation can and should be doing and vote to invest in innovative frontiers in those fields. And that's what grows an economy. We've got an economy in the toilet right now, while other nations that are heavily investing in their science and technology are passing us. If we did this, it would rejuvenate the entire technological infrastructure of the nation, as it did in the 1960s.
Neil deGrasse Tyson is the director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History. Thank you, Neil.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Passengers of the Costa Concordia will get a payout from the company. The Italian cruise ship that capsized a couple weeks ago is paying $14,500 to passengers who weren't injured. That's to compensate them for lost bags and psychological trauma. They will also get a refund.
Now to Tibet, where they've been holding some of the largest protests against Chinese rule in years. Chinese security forces opened fire this week on demonstrators, killing at least four people. Now, the protests are political in nature, but as our China Bureau chief Rob Schmitz reports, there's an economic backdrop to the tension, too.
For the past decade, the Chinese government has taken its formula for economic development in its prosperous East and then pasted it onto the less developed regions of the West. Robbie Barnett directs the Modern Tibetan Studies Program at Columbia University. He says this formula has made many Tibetans feel left out.
Of course, they get better roads and more airports, but that also brings in a lot of outside migrants, entrepreneurs, who are mostly Chinese. And so the tensions rapidly develop.
Barnett says it's less about Han Chinese coming into the region and making money. He says the bigger issue is many Tibetans feel like they're being shut out of the economic planning in a region where for centuries they were the majority. 5 years ago, there were 2 million nomads roaming Tibetan parts of China. Barnett says the government is working on reducing that number by half. The result, he says, is massive housing projects where Tibetans aren't given the training to transition into the labor force. He says the projects are hotbeds for the type of unrest Chinese police have been dealing with all this week. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
All right, now to something completely different. Stacey, it is a holiday today. Did you know that?
No. Why are we at work?
Good question. It is Earned Income Tax Credit Awareness Day, which is a holiday that was invented by the IRS to alert middle and low-income Americans to some tax savings that might be due to them. New Hampshire Public Radio's Dan Gorenstein has more now on the IRS's PR stunt.
Usually infomercials sound too good to be true, right?
The Ginzu 2000 can saw a lead pipe and still slice a tomato like this.
You expect this kind of shtick from a company peddling steak knives, but the IRS?
Oh, the things you would do if you just had some extra money, right? Well, maybe you do have money waiting for you.
Really?
At the IRS.
You're kidding, right?
They're not. The IRS says every year, taxpayers leave billions on the table. The Earned Income Tax Credit is for low and moderate wage earners, like Candy Robarge.
I just received a bill in from my son's college that was $8,000, and I almost choked.
Money so tight for the hair salon owner, she and her son constantly unplug everything from the toaster to the TV to save on electric. But thanks to the Earned Income Tax Credit, she's got enough to pay that bill off.
It's a relief for me. I'm going to be able to help my son.
But wait, there's more.
Not only is Robarge keeping her kid in school, with this cushion, she's even started a little Roth IRA. So call now to learn more about, I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Samsung Electronics posted a record profit last quarter, more than $4.5 billion. That was mostly thanks to smartphone sales. The company sold an estimated 300 million phones last year.
Now to some of the latest rankings on the best airports in the world. And Stacey, not good news for us here in the United States. Only one terminal in the United States makes the top 10 on the list from Fromers.com. It is JetBlue's Terminal 5 at New York's JFK. Meanwhile, the U.S. is home to 4 of the 10 worst airports on the list. That includes Delta's Terminal 3 at JFK. So JFK is really the best and the worst, I guess.
The best of airports and the worst of airports.
Now, does it matter to the economy? Well, that is the question we're going to put now to Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, Chris, why does a good airport matter to our economy, really?
Well, besides that, a bad airport is a miserable experience whenever you travel. Look, over the years, you've talked a lot about this evolving global economy. And if you think about it, you know, airports, airlines, commercial aviation, I mean, this is a linchpin infrastructure in this global economy. It's important locally, it's important nationally, it's important around the world, and the U.S. accounts for about a third of the world's total air traffic. So if the United States wants to continue to be the major player in the global economy, you need a really efficient, robust aviation system.
But we've got incredibly high unemployment right now. We've got very high deficits. Should we really be spending money on airports or high-speed trains or other infrastructure like that at a time like this?
You know, Jeremy, it's really striking whether you're doing research into the airports and the airlines or looking at the railways or the roads. You know, there's a constant theme that our transportation network is starved of investment capital, that we've neglected it for too long. And the thing about public investment in transportation is that it makes the private sector more efficient. So it's easier for people to do business travel. It's easier for goods to travel their way on an airplane. A lot of goods have to go on airplanes. Think of FedEx and UPS. So this is the kind of investment that makes the private sector more efficient, which would lead to more jobs, which leads to more wealth.
But does this kind of investment have to happen right now at a time when we've got such big problems?
Yeah. I was watching Ben Bernanke in his press conference the other day, and there was a question about low interest rates that savers are getting. And he said, well, that's, you know, the economy that we're in. Well, let's flip it around. Those low interest rates, that means that the cost of capital, the cost of building your infrastructure is really cheap. The time to do it is now. Cost of capital is low, and there's a lot of labor that would like a job.
Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell. Chris, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And finally, Stacey, to the German parliament, which had to put some big important issues like the European debt crisis aside yesterday because of an email.
Really?
Yes. It was sent by someone named Babette to the entire staff. That's 4,000 people. And it said, please bring me a copy of the new directory. So she, you know, she accidentally replied all. She said, please bring me a copy of the new directory. Then everybody starts writing back, saying all kinds of other funny things and just this flood of emails to the entire staff. One of them said, I'd like to take this opportunity to say hello to my mother. Then, of course, came the angry emails, and they said, please remove me from the list immediately. But in the end, one staffer was actually happy with the chain that Babette started, writing, quote, I think this is great. We should do it once a month. It'll help us grow together.
Oh, now, that's nice.
Yeah, so that's nice. So they obviously liked it. No word yet on whether Angela Merkel was particularly happy with Babette today. We'll have to see.
Or if Babette got her new directory.
I guess that's a good question. Well, next time on Marketplace Midday Update. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.